Today on Radio Chatter, it's Hired Gun. Legendary bass player and just really nice guy, Rudy Sarzo. As Hired Gun hits the theaters nationwide on June 29th for one night only, this is a movie about hired gun musicians. He was a hired gun for Ozzy, for Ronnie James Dio, for Whitesnake. Of course, an original member of Quiet Riot and a ton more. We talk about the special skill he brought to the Ozzy camp in the early days, as well as what band he didn't make. And looking back on it, he's grateful for.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, two, one, and liftoff.
This is Radio Chatter with WRIF's own Meltdown.
Time to be totally honest with you guys. I was going to put together a special Hired Gun podcast. This is this new movie that's coming out about musicians who are hired guns. Everybody from Rudy Sarzo to Anita Strauss for the Alice Cooper Band, Jason Hook from Five Finger Death Punch, drumming legend Kenny Aronoff. This guy has played in so many projects, I can't even begin to list them all for you right here. You've seen these guys. You might not know their names. You know their faces, perhaps. They've played behind legendary performers like Ozzy and Alice Cooper and Billy Joel. I mean, Twisted Brown Trucker from Kid Rock's band, Hired Guns. I mean, Jason and Marlon, all those guys, great guys. They're hired guns. They're with Kid Rock, you know. He hires them, and they go out on tour. Anyways, I was going to put together a whole hired gun package, but, you know, I'm thinking to myself, this interview is so much fun, and Rudy talks about so many great, fun stories that I thought, you know what, I'm just going to put this out there for the weekend, and I'll get some more interviews for the upcoming Hired Gun documentary coming down the pipe here, hopefully soon. Yeah, we talk about what special skill set he brought to the Ozzy camp, which is hysterical. He plays on the Steel Panther record. We talk a little bit about that. He talks about his time with, of course, Ozzy, a little bit on the Whitesnake thing, Quiet Riot, of course, Ronnie James Dio. I mean, just all sorts of stuff. His love for animals, or as he likes to call them, pets. And some Randy Rhoads stories as well. Rudy's a great guy and just a great talker. Loves to tell stories and a great player as well. I can't tell you how many projects and how many records I have of his at home that you just kind of just forget about. You're like, oh, yeah, that's right. Rudy was on that project. Oh, yeah, he was on that album. Yeah. So anyways, without further ado, Rudy called like 3 minutes early. Man, he's just ready to go. And so this is how the conversation went. It's Rudy Sarzo today on Radio Chatter.
Hey, Milton, what's happening?
I'll tell you what, you're early. Rock stars are usually not early.
Yeah, they told me to call at 10:30, so I figure, you know, time for setup is, you know, call like a couple of minutes before.
Hey, that's perfect. I'm already set up, man. I'm just waiting on you, man. So how's things going out there? You in Los Angeles, I take it, or on the West Coast somewhere?
Yes, sir. I live here in L.A. I've been here since 75, 76.
Yeah.
So this is my home. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you there. Yeah, I'm in Detroit. It's a beautiful day outside, and not that you need to hear about my problems, but it's 60 degrees in the studio. There's something wrong with the air conditioning. So so I should be doing this outside, actually, is what I should be doing. So.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm very familiar with Detroit. I mean, I spent so much time there, especially during my Quiet Riot years. So, absolutely.
Yeah, you guys. Yeah, well, you know, Detroit in like the Midwest is kind of, I would assume, where your bread is buttered, so to speak, because this is like the working man's band kind of thing out here, you know?
Yeah, and back in the Quiet Riot years, our agency was based out of Detroit.
Really?
So they were always booking us in that area. I mean, as a matter of fact, our New Year's Eve of 83 to 84, we headlined Cobo Hall. And Quiet Riot. So I believe it was Night Ranger and Girls School.
Yeah, that was before I got here. I got here almost 22 years ago. I've been in Detroit. I came from Buffalo, so it's like the same kind of town, just bigger. You know what I'm saying? So.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, I love playing Buffalo too.
But yeah, I just talked to Frankie Benelli a couple months back, and it was kind of funny. One of the things that popped right into my head when you said Quiet Riot was that he says he remembers watching Spinal Tap in the back of the bus for the first time, and Kevin DeBro and David Coverdale were with him, and he said he turned around. He thought that the movie was hysterical, and those guys weren't laughing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Back in the day, every tour bus had a copy of a Spinal Tap. I guess it was as a reminder of what not to do. Don't let this happen to you. Yeah.
I think I just heard something. With the umlauts thing. Didn't Spinal Tap use that? It was like kind of like an '80s thing with Motorhead and Metallica, or I mean, Motley Crue and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many references. As a matter of fact, when I watched it for the first time in a theater with my wife to be, we were married at the time. We didn't know that it was a comedy. Because everything was so spot on. I think it's the most perfect rock and roll movie ever made. Yeah.
And of course, what's his name? Derek Smalls. He's got to be one of your heroes, right?
Yeah, well, of course, you know. I mean, the only problem is going through TSA with the cucumber.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure you've tried that a few times.
Yeah. After within the very stringent rules of boarding a plane, that's not possible anymore.
Yeah, no doubt. You're the third bass player I've talked to in the last couple of weeks. I had Fieldy from Korn on the other day, and then I had Billy Sheehan from Mr. Big and stuff. I mean, two great bass players, huh?
Yeah, love Fieldy. Yeah, I love Fieldy too. They're giants in their field.
Yeah, on the way to work today, I was listening to one of my favorite records from Ozzy that you're on, Speak of the Devil, which is such a great record. Tell me a little bit about that period.
Oh, that's a really good question. Actually, that record we had about, when I say we, Tommy Aldridge, Brett Gillis, and myself, I believe Ozzy already knew the song.
Right, right.
He already,
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys must have had to rehearse, a little bit, right?
Oh, we did for about 5 days. Uh-huh. And one of the things that's truly, as far as the music goes, the musicians, and especially my bass part, that was truly live. Because I gave notice to Sharon about 2 days after we finished recording that. We did two shows at the Ritz in New York, completely live. There was no going back and fixing stuff. So what you hear on that record, that's what we played.
Wow.
Every single note on those two shows.
But what about Ozzy?
Well, like I mentioned, I left. So I have no idea of whatever happened, of what his, which vocals did they keep? But, I would say if there's any overdub from Ozzy, I would be really surprised about that because he's a master at singing his own. It was basically a re-recording of things that Ozzy had been doing most of his life.
Right, right.
So if anybody was going to get it right live, it was going to be Ozzy.
Now, I was thinking to myself as I was driving in today, listening to that record, that you must have heard that record and just been super pleased with how the band sounded. I mean, that's one of the best sounding live albums I've ever heard to this day. And I can remember when I was a kid, I was 13, 14 years old, listening to it for the first time, just being blown away by it.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting experience. And I've actually played more. I'm better known for playing on live records because, there's been a handful of studio albums that I performed on, such as The Quiet Riot, Mental Health, and Condition Critical, and the Whitesnake, Slip of the Tongue.
Right.
But prior to that, I by the time that Tommy Aldridge and I had joined Ozzy and Randy, they had already recorded Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman. So I got to play on Tribute, which is, again, a live recording of that Blizzard of Oz 1981 tour.
Mm.
And then after that, it was the release of, Speak of the Devil was released before that, and then Tribute came out shortly after.
Yeah, I think Speak of the Devil, that was right after the death of Randy Rhoads, and I think it was something along the lines of where they just had to get something out there, keep Ozzy, going, put some product out.
Yes and no. Actually, there was, before Randy passed away, there was already planned to make that record.
Oh, okay.
And that was going to be the next record anyways in the sequence of releases for Ozzy. It just so happened that it got, it took longer to record because, of course, Randy passed away, and then we have to, reschedule everything to be released further. But there was a race between the Black Sabbath camp and the Ozzy camp to be the first one to come out with the same, basically the same content.
Really?
Because there was the Live Evil.
Oh, yeah, that's right, record. Yeah.
Yeah, they came out about the same time. Yeah,
I totally forgot about that. And that, speak of the devil, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, Ozzy actually had shaved his head, so that's like a wig or something, wasn't he wearing?
Well, for speak of the devil, what Ozzy, Ozzy had already shaved his head.
Yeah.
He did that right before we did, what was it, Texas Jam, 1982. They found him. He was missing for a few days, and Sharon found him, or whoever she sent out to look for him found him hunched over at the at his favorite pub in England with his head shaved. So as a matter of fact, I had to cut a wig. Sharon, you know, she got on the phone and told her tour manager, hey, listen, tell Rudy to go out and buy a wig and cut it like Ozzy's hair. Because, you know, the plan was to go on stage and not let people know that Ozzy has shaved his head. Because back in 1982, that was like career suicide.
Right, right.
You know, what's he, you know, a heavy metal rock star doing with his shaved head? That's a no-no. I mean, today, that was like, you know, who cares, you know? So I did. I had this styrofoam head with a wig staring at me in the hotel room like for a couple of days before Ozzy got there. And finally I got the courage to cut it. I had never cut a wig before, so I learned a whole lot from that.
So wait a second, are you saying that the wig that Ozzy had on Speak of the Devil is you cut, that was your handiwork?
Well, not until, actually, I have to take another look at the Speak of the Devil album cover, but what I'm saying is the wig that he wore at the very beginning, for the first couple, actually the first song when we started the set at the Texas Jam, it was like we went on like around 5 o'clock with in a stadium, Texas Jam, the stadium, it was called, I believe, the Cotton Bowl. You know, the big where the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, Cowboys,
play.
Right.
And the stage faced the sunset, and so by 5 o'clock, it was the sun. It was about 110 degrees, and Ozzy's got this wig on, and he's sweating his ass off. And all of a sudden, you know, we do one song. And then right before we go into Crazy Train, he starts yelling at the audience, do you think I'm, you know, bleep, 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 you know, crazy? And the audience says, yeah. And he goes, well, let me show you how crazy I am. So he takes his wig off and he throws it into the crowd. And the place just went nuts. Totally, totally apeshit, you know. And so what's going through my head is, wait a minute, we have another show tomorrow. And where am I going to get another wig? You know, I'm thinking about the wig. So for the next show, it was actually in New Orleans. And it happened to be on a Sunday. And at that time, in those days in 1982, in New Orleans being, you know, kind of like Catholic, Christian, you know, town, the South, all of the wig shops were closed on Bourbon. So I found this Merlin the Magician wig, you know, like a Halloween wig at this at the store, and I bought it. So I started kind of like cutting it, but once I started cutting into it, pieces were beginning to fall off the skull cap, you know, the skull cap. And so I just left it as it was, and so Ozzy puts it on the next day, and it had been raining, and it was muggy, and it was hot. So Ozzy just went on stage, and before we even hit one note, you know, like we had the intro, you know, Ozzy just he took it off and said, "Screw this." that was the end of the wigs right there. No more wigs for Ozzy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, who was harder to play for, Ozzy or Sharon?
Oh, listen, I am so grateful to them for having, you know, been, you know, Ozzy, Sharon, and Randy were responsible for getting, you know, giving me a career.
Right.
I went from sleeping on the floor, you know, with no track record, to them taking a chance on me. They, you know, I mean, Randy is the one who recommended me to them, you know, and he put his trust on the line so I could get the gig, you know. So, but I, you know, it's looking back at it, if it wasn't for them, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to talk too much about Ozzy. I'm a huge fan. That's kind of what turned me on to music in the early 80s was hearing Crazy Train for the first time. But one final thing about Ozzy, because I've heard you talk about this before. The Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman, you just kind of mentioned that they were kind of recorded, you know, within months of each other. But they sound so different. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and I've heard you talk in other interviews before about how Randy Rhoads actually, he just grew so fast and matured so fast and just did different things, huh?
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah, it was, recorded within months, and not even, you can compare the compositional styles. Very different. Randy had really grown as a composer, guitar player so much that he was able to apply that to the new music. But also the way it was mixed, you know, the mixing, it was kind of like one of the first, if not the first 80s album to really sound like an 80s record. Because if you listen to Blizzard, it sounds like a 70s record. It's very dry.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounding, you know, and the Diary is very ambient sounding, more like an arena rock. Mm. And I got to tell you, the first time I was sitting next to Ozzy in the tour bus when he got the cassette of the final mixes, he didn't know what to make of it. he was expecting it to sound. Yeah, I mean, sound, not the performance, not the composition, but the sound of the record, the mix, to sound like the Blizzard of Oz record, because that's what he knew. And this was so new that at first he couldn't wrap himself around it. He hated it. He hated it. It was because it was nothing like anybody had heard before. And of course, you know, with time, that record set the standard, sonic standards of records to come, you know, rock records.
Yeah, that's those records were really, I mean, of course Ozzy was looking for an identity after leaving Black Sabbath and doing all this stuff. We could talk about Ozzy for hours, but let's talk about this Hired Gun movie. Why do you think you're a hired gun, and how come you never really, you know, grabbed onto a band for any real length of time and stuck it out with them?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I was not a hired gun with Quiet Riot. I'm actually a founding member, you know. But, you know, if you're going to look at my trajectory, when I started with Ozzy as a hired gun, the reason why I left was because after Randy died, I lost all my joy of making music, you know, in that environment, you know, going on stage, right after he passed away within 10 days. And, you know, everything was the same except Randy wasn't there, you know. And the only way that I could actually deal with it was to shield myself emotionally. I was just playing notes. You know, I wasn't relating to anything. You know, I couldn't even look at the audience. I couldn't look at the other guys in the band. I just became robotic, you know. So I actually went in the studio just to record one song for what became Metal Health as a tribute to Randy, Thunderbird. So I'm in the studio with Frankie, who I had played with since 1972, you know, 10 years prior. I grew up playing, you know, with Frankie and Kevin, who I, you know, best friends and bandmates, you know, from the Randy Rhoads Quiet Riot. I lived with him right before I joined Ozzy. And, you know, I found myself in a really emotional refuge, a really good place, you know, to be at, you know, while playing with those guys. And if you can imagine my pain of continuing with Ozzy without Randy, because I left one of the biggest bands in the world for the complete unknown.
Right.
Nobody thought that Quiet Riot was going to even come close to achieving what we did, you know, especially in Los Angeles, you know. So fast forward to Quiet Riot. The reason why I left Quiet Riot in 1985 was because there were too many personal conflicts. And again, I had lost the joy of playing. To me, if you're not happy making music, you're not making music. You just play a bunch of notes. And I'm all about music. It's the music. And you cannot fool the audience. The audience knows whether it's real, the real deal, or you just kind of like, you know, surviving the situation, which is basically what I was. So I put music first and moved on. And then a couple of years later, I'm in Whitesnake. And David, in 1990, gave us notice right at the very beginning of the Slip of the Tongue tour that this was going to be the last Whitesnake tour for a while. He wanted to, you know, concentrate on his family, mm-hmm. you know. And so I had no choice. The band was going to end, you know. So then a few years later, I rejoined the reunited version of Quiet Riot in 1997. And one of the things that always stuck to my mind was the question, what if I would have stayed in Quiet Riot and survived all the emotional, everything that was going, you know, all the conflicts,
yeah.
emotional conflicts that I had in the group. And so in 97, when we reunited, that gave me the opportunity to find the answer to that and get closure. Basically, that's what I needed to do, get some closure with Quiet Riot. And so the band disbanded in 2003, that version of the, you know, the original Metal Health members
wow.
in 2003. And but I got closure, you know. Then the following year, I joined Dio. And I thought, oh, my God, this is, you know, I'm playing with Ronnie James Dio. I learned so much from him. That was an incredible, incredible journey that I had with Ronnie. And unfortunately, I was his last Dio bass player.
Mm.
You know, he passed away, you know, way too soon,
right.
you know. And so, you know, since then I've been, you know, looking for a home. And recently I just joined as a permanent member, the Guess Who.
Oh, really?
which is a band that I grew up playing their music. They have 17 hits. They're major part of the soundtrack of my life, you know. So it's not like I really plan on moving from here to there and whatsoever. It's just that's it's been my destiny, you know, so far. And hopefully I get to, you know, the Guess Who, you know, has a long life ahead for all of us, you know.
Yeah.
The band, because I really enjoy the band, everything about it, the music, the members, everything, the organization, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, they're great bands. Burton Cummings and all that still with the band and everything, all you guys tour?
No, it's up until before I joined the band, it was the original rhythm section that have, you know, the ownership of the name.
Okay.
Gary Peterson, Jim Cale, and Jim basically passed me the torch on stage in Las Vegas a couple of months ago in front of the audience, you know, and told the audience that I was going to be, you know, taking his place. Dear man, really, really wonderful musician too. But it's Gary Peterson, you know, the original drummer. Burton Cummings and Randy Bachman, as you know, they've had their solo career, very successful solo career, and they have not been an official member of the Guess Who for decades now.
Okay, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. I remember seeing Burton Cummings, I guess, now that you mentioned it, way back in the day doing some solo stuff, but... Yeah.
Magnificent musician. Yeah.
That's a little bit out of my wheelhouse. Like I said, growing up in Buffalo and listening to, you know, Black Sabbath and Ozzy and all through the 80s stuff. And that was a little bit, still a little bit classic for me as far as that stuff goes. Just recently, I actually tweeted you about this, and I don't know if I was the first one to do it or whatever, but I tweeted you a few months back that you played on the Steel Panther record.
Yes, I did. And actually, I have forgotten about it.
Oh, is that right? Because you tweeted me back. You're like, yeah, the cat's out of the bag or something like that.
Yeah. I was waiting for an official announcement from their camp.
Oh, okay.
About it. And I forgot. You know, it's just, I play so many records. I play on at least 4 or 5 albums a year, and they are not my own band.
Right.
So, some of them are, you know, I have this group that is Japanese centric, It's called Annie Metal USA. And sometimes we do, the singer and I, we do a side project called D-Metal, which stands for Disney Metal. And a few months ago, we released it's a heavy metal Disney record of all, you know, like Disney hits, you know.
Really?
And, yeah, and you know what? You just do it and you move on to something else, you know, because it's not... It's not an entity that you have a tour plan with. You know, there might be requests from some dates here and there, but it's not like in the old days that when you made a record, you were going to go on tour and make videos and you know, like in many cases, like let's say in Whitesnake or Quiet Riot, you know, making those videos were extend our tour life for a year to a year and a half.
Right, it became real cyclical, where now you record stuff. Now, you're saying that you record stuff for other bands as well that you're not in. I guess hence the term hired gun. Is there anything that we've heard recently that you've been on?
Again,
I have to tweet you about it in a few months.
Yeah, exactly. I was up in Canada with a dear friend of mine, who actually her husband is the lead singer in the Guess Who. Her name is Sass Jordan.
Oh, Sass Jordan, and, for sure. Yeah, I didn't know her husband was in the Guess Who. Okay, all the Canadian ties there. Yeah, there you go.
That's right. Derek Sharp, yeah. And we did Scene Revisited, which is like the 25th anniversary. So that's coming out in the next few months. And we went to a studio in Calgary, beautiful place, and we just cut the record, you know, like in the old days. Uh-huh. The whole band in the studio at the same time recording. And, yeah, you know, it's just... Yeah, that's the way to go. That's when the magic happens, you know. I just did that. I also just completed a record for Pamela Moore. Yeah, I don't know if you remember her. She was Sister Mary in
Queensryche.
Operation Mindcrack.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a fabulous singer, fabulous. And I played on the whole record. I did the D-Metal record that I mentioned. I'm about to do a record for a project called Dream Child, which is basically Craig Goldie and Simon Wright and myself, you know, former Dio bandmate. And a couple of other musicians, and I should start tracking on that within the next couple of weeks. The Guess Who has a new record coming out. So, yeah, I always got all this stuff going on. There's also a record that I did with a guitar player from Canada named Adrian Rasso with Vinny Appice and myself.
Oh, really?
That was an all-instrumental record. You know, kind of like the old-fashioned Jeff Beck type, you know, which are always fun to do. There's so much more room to play, you know, as musicians rather than to be kind of like a backing soundtrack for vocals, you know, which is also great because, you know, but they're both different approaches that you take musically.
What about this band with Dan Spitz and Dean Castronova? Are you doing a project with those guys?
Yeah, we talked about it, and I was very clear with Dan that, you know, I am a member of the Guess Who, and everything that I do, you know, they're a priority.
Right.
And that everything that I do has to, you know, cannot conflict with their schedule. And, you know, so you know, we're going to make it work.
Okay.
You know, because I'm a big fan of Dan's and Dean's. You know, hey, Dan and Dean.
I'll tell you what, man. Your career is unbelievable. You've had the pleasure and the privilege to play with some of my favorites. I mean, like I said, Ozzy. I was a huge Dio fan. I only met him once, and what a great guy. He stood up and hugged me and thanked me for coming on the bus afterwards, and it was like I was just so thrilled because I was such a fan growing up, and you said that was really a moving time for you working with him, huh?
Absolutely. I learned, you know, by the time I started working with Ronnie, I thought that I had seen and learned everything. No, there was so much more to learn. And I learned that from being in his company. What a magnificent human being all around.
Yeah, what a great guy. Hey, real fast, we'll cut you loose here in just a minute here. Rudy, thank you so much for the time. Have you seen the entire Hired Gun movie completed?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Five times. And it's an incredible journey to see all of these musicians, all these different storylines coming together in one film, you know. And the director did such a great job in actually telling, and there's a constant arc to the story, but from so many different points of view. So you get a full picture of what it is like to be a hired gun or to have a hired gun phase in your career. Because let's face it, with the exception of very, very few musicians, everybody at some point has or will be a hired gun. That goes without saying. You know, I mean, even the Beatles were hired by this singer named Tony Sheridan. I mean, you can Google this. Like their first recording session.
I'm going to have to. I don't remember that. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Tony Sheridan backing up, the Beatles backing up Tony Sheridan, and the record was My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean.
Oh, okay.
And a rock and roll version. So even the Beatles were hired guns. So everybody goes through that, you know.
Yeah,
there's some amazing stories. I mean, I learn a lot myself from watching the documentary about some of my greatest recordings and people that I'm a fan of, about the process of writing, being creative, the creative process of a hired gun. Because a lot of times you're hired because of what you can bring to the chemistry of that record or the performance. You know, it's based on who you are.
Well, I've seen you wrote or I heard an interview with you or whatever. You're like the piece of the puzzle that they're looking for, and you got to slide in. You got to make yourself fit.
Yeah, and I am aware that that I joined the band. That your band doesn't join me. So I adapt. You have to adapt to, you know, you have to look at that hole that you're filling in, and it has to be seamless.
Yeah.
You know, once you fit in, you know, you have to be, you have to become that piece, that missing piece of the puzzle. So you have to adapt to whatever shape or form that might be.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the video online, and one of the things that struck me in the movie was when Kenny Aronoff was talking about doing that drum fill in that John Mellencamp song. And I don't even know the one, Let It Rock, you know, the whole thing. And he does that big drum fill. I'm like, oh my God, that's like amazing to hear the story about how that came about.
Absolutely. And the film is full of stories like that. It's truly a revelation of the creative process.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That comes out at the end of June in theaters, and we'll be here in Detroit checking that, I believe, June 29th. Real fast,
June 29th.
Last thing for you here. Actually, two last things. How many projects have you tried out for that you didn't make?
One.
That's it? Just one, huh?
Eddie Money.
Really?
Eddie Money, and with all due respect to Eddie, because I'm a big fan, thank God I didn't get the gig, because shortly after that, I got the Ozzy gig.
Really? That long ago, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, but then again, it was one of those situations that I understood. By the time, because I met Eddie at the record plant in Los Angeles, and we hung out, he liked my vibe, and he sent me up to San Francisco to audition without him. He was still in the studio recording. So the guys that I was auditioning for was his band. And by the time that I got there, there was already a bass player that they knew, that they trusted. And so basically, I would, you know, they just put me through the motion. Oh, yeah, let's bring this guy out because Eddie wants us to check him out. But you know, so-and-so already has the gig. So, you know, I went in there, and I even before I played one note, I got it. There's already a bass player in the room. You know, it's just like, yeah, okay. So I didn't get that gig, but thank God, because a few months later, I got the Ozzy gig. So,
right.
You know, there you go.
Yeah, things happen for a reason. And last thing here for you, Rudy, I see on your Twitter and stuff, I follow you, that you do a lot of stuff with animal charities. You want to tell everybody about that?
Yeah, you know, it's just a matter of creating awareness for animals, about pets. Right. I hate to use the word animal because, you know, to me, they're family, you
right.
know. And it's to create awareness that that these fur babies are available, you know, because, you know, I think that, you know, I have most of my friends have pets, you know, have a furry family. And I I can see it in myself, you know, like you know, about a year ago, our Tori, she was, you know, she lived with us for, you know, 17 years, and she passed away, and you know, and you have this huge hole in your life when they're gone, you know, and it just changes your everything about you, and so a few months later, I would say about 6 to 7 months later, we decided to bring into our lives another, you know, member of the family. It's just it changes your dynamics. You know, I think it adds so many positive things to your life that I truly believe it makes you a better person.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
I think everybody can use that positive influence that unconditional love in your life, you know, brings.
Yeah, it's crazy when I come home and my dog every single day does the same thing. First he barks because he doesn't know who's there, and then he runs back into the living room and he comes back out with one of his toys just to show me, and you know, his tail's wagging and the whole thing, you know, every single day no matter what happens. So I was telling the girl that's on the radio before me here on WRIF, I said, yeah, I'm talking to Rudy Sarzo today. She goes, oh my God, I interviewed him with Whitesnake and I love his hair. Legendary hair.
Well, thank God I still have it. That's all I can say.
Well, Rudy, listen, thank you so much for the time. Hired Gun comes out at the end of June, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing this. I know a few Hired Guns. John 5, I know the guys from Twisted Brown Trucker, Kid Rock's band. Tony Miranda is one of my friends. I don't know if that name rings a bell. He's a drummer. He's played on all sorts of records and stuff. So anyways, it's going to be an interesting view, and I'm looking forward to checking it out. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. God bless you, Milltown.
Just some killer stories right there. You know, I could really talk to Rudy for like 6 hours. I mean, really. I mean, that guy, can you imagine the stories he's got that, I mean, he just touched on a couple of them with Ozzy and some different things. I mean, we didn't even get into stories with Quiet Riot and Ronnie James Dio and the whole thing, but man, unbelievable. He was like pretty much on the soundtrack of my childhood growing up through the 80s and stuff, and listening to some of these bands. Man, how cool is that? Rudy Sarzo today. Hired Gun is going to be in the theaters nationwide on June 29th for one night only. If you're listening to this right here in Detroit, it's going to be at the Forum 30 in Sterling Heights, Livonia 20 in Livonia, and Commerce Township 14 in Walled Lake. I'll put all the information on the bed of this podcast. So thank you guys so much for checking it out. If you like this, give us a 5-star rating, give us a review, and of course share this with your friends. And I'm definitely going to be sharing this because Rudy was fantastic. Hopefully you guys go out and check out the movie, and hopefully before the movie comes out on June 29th, we'll have some more of the guests coming up on the Radio Chatter podcast. Like I said in the last podcast, Don Jameson from That Metal Show, he's got this new Communication Breakdown record that's out right now, and I ran into him at Rock on the Range, and he said, hey, let's podcast, so I'm down for that. So he should be coming up here pretty soon, and I've also got the irons and a couple other fires of some guests we're going to have coming up real soon on the Radio Chatter podcast. So please, if you get a chance, subscribe so you don't miss any of it. Thank you so much, as always, for checking out Radio Chatter.